Hello, everybody. Welcome to News for the Soul. This is Daniel Brinkley.
This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. We know that we choose to come to this world, and we're chosen to come to this world, and we've come for breath. We breathe in for ourselves and out for spiritual unfoldment. And as we breathe these moments, let's open up our heart and open up our souls, and let the true awareness of News for the Soul make its impact now and forever.
I'm Nicole Whitney, and this is News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. It is, oh my goodness, it's almost the end of February already. It's flying by Thursday, February 22nd, and we have some great news for the soul for you today. I want to let you know before we dive in here that we do have all of our archives for all of the years of the show, for it, all of its running, all free all the time on our website. In case you don't know, you can go and listen to amazing shows there all the time. Newsforthesoul.com is where you go. It's all life-changing and it's all free 24/7. And very exciting stuff. We are planning an update. Just so you know, lighten up literally. We've been 2 weeks short of the updates that we have promised you. This is a consciousness experiment that we are doing, weight loss with the power of one's mind. Why not? Sounds easier than the other ways. And it has been a very interesting journey so far. And it has taken a new turn. We have a huge announcement that we're making later this week, and you don't want to miss it. Also, Daisy Knight was rescheduled at the last minute, and she's coming back in March to be with us and specifically to talk about change your mind, change your waveline. So create your reality, may as well create our waveline. It can't be any different. Anyway, but today we have a guest I've been looking forward to talking to for some time. Dr. T. Lee Bowman. He is a retired MD and author of God at the Speed of Light and several other interesting, intriguing-sounding books, all of which seem to be tying together the spirit and science aspects into one little, neat little package with a twist. So we're going to talk to him about that, and this full hour, that's what we're going to be doing. I believe his website we've got it linked up on our site, but I think it is near-death.com/physics.html. But you can find that link on newsforthesoul.com if you get tired of typing. So let's welcome him on and start the fun. Dr. Bowman, welcome to the show.
Well, Nicole, thank you for having me on News for the Soul, and please just call me Lee.
Okay, I will do that, and thank you for being here. We're better for you to be. This is an intriguing subject and one of my personal favorites, of course. I'm curious as to, with your background in the medical field, how did you get into the whole spiritual realm? Where does the spiritual path start for you?
Well, Nicole, what happened was I found myself in the mid-1970s, having just been in the practice of medicine for a few short years. I was never someone who could accept the premise of God based upon faith alone. And I respect those that can. My wife, my own mother are two such individuals, but having gone through pre-medical education, science, biology, chemistry, having heard all of the arguments for Darwin's theory of evolution, which was so logical, I couldn't bring myself to believe in a higher being based just upon faith, and that was where I found myself in the mid-1970s. However, I, at the same time, developed a keen interest in Einstein. He was one of my role models, I guess. I was intrigued by his theory of relativity, did a lot of reading on that, and found something very inexplicable and very supernatural dealing with the special element of the special theory, where time stopped if you could travel at light speed. At that time, I didn't fully understand all of the ramifications of that, but I continued my reading. Obviously, being a physician, I was especially intrigued when Raymond Moody came out with his first book, Life After Life, dealing with the near-death experience, and here I was in the practice of geriatric medicine and internal medicine. So, unfortunately, I was dealing with that aspect of resuscitating patients and wondering what was going on. And one thing led to another, and as all of your listeners, I'm sure, are aware, you know, one of the main elements of the near-death experience is the being of light. And this being is often associated with Christ if you're a Christian, God if you're other faiths, and if you're agnostic or atheist, often you just identify the being of light with a guiding spirit, you know, a non-denominational guiding spirit. So one book led to another, and I continued to find one account of the near-death experience as interesting as the first one. Similarly, each book I read on quantum physics and Einstein, I was continually picking out pearls, and eventually I realized that these physicists, and we're talking about Nobel Prize winners like Richard Feynman and Niels Bohr, you know, the giants of the field, describing physical light almost in terms of that we typically ascribe to God, you know, being omniscient, being omnipresent, even omnipotence. And I just found it fascinating, and it, unfortunately, not having a real strong physics background, it took me about 20 years to fully comprehend what all these terms meant. So that was what happened to me, and that was my physical and spiritual growth. And I found myself just a concrete believer in a higher being 20 years later.
There's a big difference, isn't there, between trying to have faith in something and having a direct experience with something.
Well, that's true. Unfortunately, I never, you know, I consider myself what I call psychically deprived. I never had a near-death experience. I really never have experienced anything that I would consider paranormal, which many people, as I'm, you know, you're fully aware that they have a near-death experience, and it has to be an incredible spiritual upheaval, and it can transform people. Not having had that personally, I had to rely upon science to bring me around, and I was surprised it did, because I always considered it science an adversary to spirituality, not an ally. So it was a very revealing spiritual cycle for me, and I feel very fortunate to have found what I consider the answer.
Well, it's an amazing and growing group that I have been blessed to connect with and talk to over the years that is, you know, the science background, all saying the same thing. They came around full circle and poof, back to spirit.
It is a great thing. I mean, because 20 years ago, most scientists just felt there was no place for God in, you know, the realm of science. Between Darwin's theory of evolution and the Big Bang theory, you didn't need God. Science was telling us that, you know, everything happened from nothing and without a requirement for any type of higher design. And it, at the time, it made sense, but I feel that science, similarly, now has gone full circle, a paradigm shift, if you will, and is saying exactly the opposite, that really I can't see how a scientific mind currently could refute the existence of a higher power. So that's where I am in my spiritual journey.
Well, before we get more into the aspect of light and the topic of your latest book, I want to ask you, because you sort of tweaked my interest there when you were talking about the experiences as you worked in the geriatric field in medicine, that things, you started wondering if things were happening. Were people, did people ever tell you some odd things that they saw or experienced?
Well, yes. I've had conversations with several individuals who have had near-death experiences, everything from the good type of near-death experience where they've seen the light and experienced the peace and the warmth and the love, all the way to the near-death experiences where they've experienced none of that, and it was all darkness, groping figures, you know, trying to pull them into this dark realm. So I've had both sides, and I feel very fortunate that people have felt comfortable enough with me to divulge these very personal moments, because we all know that you can't talk to just anybody about these type of things because they will think you're absolutely nuts.
Yeah, especially the general medical community, I would think, you know, overall.
Yep.
was this in the course of researching a book, or was this as your patients in the hospital?
Well, actually, a little bit of both. I remember even as early as when I was a resident, being called up to the floor, as many residents are found to have to do to pronounce a patient. Typically, the personal physician is outside of the hospital late at night, and that's what the residents are often used for on a temporary basis, to pronounce someone dead. So I was called up on this one floor, and being a young resident, still feeling a bit naive and intimidated by this whole medical process, I made sure I took my time. I listened very carefully to see if there were heart sounds. I listened very carefully to make sure there were no lung sounds at all, or breathing in any of the lung fields. And, you know, I really did my work and felt there was absolutely no doubt this poor individual was dead. So I pronounced him dead and signed the papers as we were instructed to do. Went on my way and was carrying about my business in the hospital, and about half an hour later I was called by a floor nurse, and she said, Dr. Bauman, that patient you pronounced about half an hour ago is now up, alert, and talking. So I think that was my first experience. Unfortunately, this patient was old and had a problem with senility, so it wasn't something where I could sit down and talk to them about, you know, any type of on the other side experience. But nonetheless, that was, I think, my very first exposure with realizing that medicine was indeed an art, that there was a lot going on that we did not fully comprehend.
So, I mean, you were positive he was dead, gone, goodbye.
Oh, there was no doubt. And, you know, you can read accounts even in the ancient literature as far back as Plato, or even some of Moody's work or Melvin Morse's work, where people are pronounced dead or felt to be dead, and they have, I remember one person even was reported to have laid in cold storage in an autopsy room for like 3 days before they found that he was alive. So there are some really bizarre stories out there which I have no doubt are absolutely true. It's quite a new field of research that we have confronting us these days.
So as you, you know, went on your journey and you were collecting this data and talking about near-death experiences, have you ever talked to Daniel Brinkley, by the way?
I have not talked with him. If I'm not mistaken, I believe he's one of your co-hosts, is he not?
Yeah, he used to be on, actually in the first 2 years of News to the Soul, he was on every show when we were on the air.
I've read his books. I love his work. I would look forward to speaking to him sometime.
Well, my understanding of his story is he was dead 28 minutes and he had the toe tag and was
right.
Shipped off down to the morgue as you know, his experience ensued. And one of the more dramatic accounts, of course, there's so many now. And one question comes to mind is how accurate, you know, I mean, the first obvious question, if that's happening a lot where people are popping back up, is how accurate, like, how do we know really that someone is dead? Like, what kind of accuracy level in your pronouncement process?
Oh, and that's a great question. Unfortunately, it's a very difficult one to respond to. I think, you know, the field of medicine is such that the average practitioner is really left in the vast majority of cases with just his or her stethoscope. You know, you listen to the heart, you listen to the lung fields, you don't feel a pulse. Some may even check a blood pressure just to make sure that the heart isn't, you know, beating and maintaining such a low blood pressure that you're missing a lot of those findings. But apart from that, I would say the vast majority of cases utilize those tools. I know for practitioners that work and spend a lot of time in the intensive care unit, they, you know, often use Dopplers or ultrasounds to actually be able to measure very low blood pressures. So there are certainly examples that we are aware of where patients can maintain very low blood pressures, and it's conceivable, you know, that could be occurring. However, even under those pretenses, you would still expect them to be breathing. So, you know, I think arguments could probably be made on both sides as to why or why not people might be diagnosed as dead when they're actually not. But it really depends on how critically you evaluate the patient and what tools you have at your disposal.
Not really carefully.
But you would think so.
Hope so. But nonetheless, it doesn't explain, you know, whether they're in some kind of stasis or not. It doesn't explain the experience and the same experiences, the similarities. So at what point did you start going from clinical, you know, medical doctor to really believing that there was something more, really knowing that there was something more?
Well, I think a lot of people can appreciate that the first time you read about these concepts of quantum physics, like the fact that light can theoretically be everywhere at one moment, some of those concepts are just so bizarre and difficult to accept. But that was one reason it fully took me a good 20 years of rereading the same experiments over and over again, rereading the same concepts and proofs and theorems and whatnot, because they really are difficult concepts to accept. That they're just, you know, so incredible. You have Nobel Prize winners like Richard Feynman describing the double slit experiment, which is one of the classic experiments to first imply that light has some type of almost conscious behavior. And he described the experiment as being just impossible. And then you have Nobel Prize winner Niels Bohr, who states, you know, those people who are not shocked when they first come across quantum physics could not possibly have understood it. And that's how I was about, you know, 20 years ago, reading about these crazy concepts that physicists were talking about. You know, these weren't preachers or ministers talking about these spiritual events in the scientific world. These were physicists. So it did. It really took me a good 20 years to integrate these concepts and then to put two and two together and realize, well, how is God described throughout the world's literature and all of the planet's sacred texts? And he or she is always described in terms of light. And, you know, I don't need to say anything about the near-death experience. I think that's well accepted as well. And I no longer, at that point, you know, the light bulb went off, and I felt that so many of these descriptors in the world's religious texts were not just metaphors. I began to think that they might very well be literal. And that's where I am now. I do believe they are literal.
It's quite ironic that it was the light bulb that went off.
No pun intended, of course.
So you're saying that it's so literal that light itself could be, quote-unquote, God.
You know, I have to say that I hope I'm not so naive that I feel that I have all the answers. And I want everyone listening to understand that. I do not have all the answers. I continue to search for the answers. But my research really brings me to the conclusion that there is an intimate relationship between physical light and God. And I have to seriously consider that there is the possibility that they may well be one and the same.
So list the qualities then that are of the same nature for light and how God is described.
Yes, well, I call them the three omnis, and the fourth quality is that of consciousness. I briefly mentioned, and often it's one of the most difficult to explain, so I will save it for last, but the concept of light being conscious goes back to that double slit experiment that I mentioned briefly about when I was speaking about Richard Feynman. Probably the easiest of the three omnis to describe is the omni of omnipresence, or the fact that light theoretically can be everywhere at one time. Now, I don't ask anyone to buy that just from the statement alone, but let me explain. Einstein basically showed, and it's been subsequently proven, that when light travels at light speed, which we obviously know it does, the time stops. So if you accept that, and by the way, that for anyone who's interested in looking it up, they can actually look up the subatomic particle called a muon, which is probably the best proof that these particles actually, time actually slows for them. So let's assume that you buy the proof that time stops for photons. Then if a photon were to start at one corner of the universe and begin its journey to another far corner of the universe, even though for humans, for us humans, we see that light wave as traveling at a certain speed, for that light wave itself, time does not exist. So excluding how it appears to us humans, because we're trapped within the four dimensions of space and time, and that's really the main explanation for why it appears to be different for humans versus light. For light, it really exists outside of time. So its perception of reality is cannot be compared to what we humans experience. So time does not exist. So theoretically, that photon or that light wave can travel around and around the universe, and how many seconds goes by on its clock? Well, the answer is none. And so theoretically, that light wave can be everywhere in the universe at once. Now, I was reading about physicists actually saying this in you know, book after book after book, and I think it's probably not too hard to conceptualize why it took me 20 years to accept that. You know, it just doesn't make any sense, because as a human, we know it travels at 186,000 miles per second, but we forget time exists for us, and time does not exist for the light wave, just as we argue that God is not confined to four dimensions either. So if you buy that argument, then that explains the omnipresence of light, the fact that light can theoretically be everywhere. And again, the key term is theoretically. So let's just assume you accept that premise. The second omni is that of omniscience, or being all-knowing. So let's assume you're a light wave or a photon. You can be everywhere in the universe at one time. Now, if I could be everywhere in the universe at one time, I would know everything that's going on in the universe at that moment, wouldn't I? And if you expand that concept, you can say, okay, for a light wave, not only does time not exist, but really the past is the same as the present, is the same as the future. You know, it's just a semantic explanation for time not being present. So if that's true, that light wave not only knows everything that's going on right now, but it knows everything that's gone on in the past. It knows everything that's going to occur in the future. And lo and behold, when you look at many near-death survivors, what's one of the things that they describe when they're on the other side? They often say, you know, at the time I was having that experience, when I was exposed to the light and all that love and that peace, I had all the answers to the universe. And they will tell you this. They knew everything. You know, they were omniscient. But yet, when they come back, it's gone. When they come back within the realm of time and the three dimensions of space, it's gone. And it's a great example of what I think, you know, is the second omni, the omni of omniscience. Now, the third omni of omnipotence, or being all-powerful, like we often describe God, is a little bit more problematic. And that omni, again, comes about through a physics technique or experiment. The story of that is that in the early 1900s, physicists were calculating the energy levels of atomic particles, like electrons. The answers they kept getting was that the electron had infinite energy, and they knew that that wasn't right. They knew something was wrong. Well, to make a long story short, if you go back to your basic sciences and remember how electrons circle the nucleus and atoms, those electrons bounce between electron orbitals, or between electron shells around the nucleus, by doing what? And the answer is that they either absorb light, which gives them energy to jump to a higher level, or they release light, which allows them to fall to a electron orbital level closer to the nucleus. So the interaction with, or between rather, electrons and light is very close-knit. It's really inseparable. You cannot study an electron without also studying its interaction with the photon, because they're so closely interwoven. That was the problem. And physicists could not get rid of that contribution that light was making to these subatomic particles. They had to actually devise a mathematical technique, and again, for those wishing to look it up on the internet, it's known as renormalization. That's the word normal, R-E in front, ization at the end, renormalization. And a lot of physicists feel it's nothing more than a mathematical trick. Some have called it a sleight of hand, you know, like a magician's trick. And they don't feel it's a valid technique. But yet, it's still being used today as the only method to get rid of the contributions, the infinite contributions, being made by photons in subatomic particles, particularly the electron or even the smallest atoms like the hydrogen atom. I have to admit, I still struggle with that particular concept a bit even now, but that would be the argument for omnipotence. If you're ready, I can go move right on to consciousness. Or if you have other questions, I can entertain that.
I was just going to say I was, intriguing aspects of the light that you talked about. When you talked about the non-pleasant near-death experience,
yeah,
with the shadowy figures trying to pull them into darkness,
exactly,
absence of light, you know, it's interesting.
Well, you know, not wishing to be a real pessimist, but you hear these stories and you search for reasons for why that might be happening. And probably the most prevalent explanation I like to give these people at least some hope, because I don't think it would be very pleasant if I experienced it. What I like to tell them is, you know, even in the total darkness of outer space, which is a complete vacuum, and there's no visible light at all, what we do know is that from the cosmic background radiation, there's a non-visible light, even in the darkest depths of space. There's over 400 million photons of non-visible light per cubic meter. So there is still light there. And, you know, so many of these people, if you talk to them and you hear other stories about NDEs, the people who say, oh, Christ, or oh, God, help me, you know, in this moment of need, what often happens? That darkness disappears and they're bathed in light. Now, I'll have to admit, I have never heard the story when people have been in these dark depths and they've said, God, help me, and they weren't helped. I'm sure they're probably out there, but I don't remember ever hearing that particular story. So that's something better as well.
Comforting. Glad I asked that. Non-visible light. Wow. There you go.
And you know, I think if you find yourself in that situation, I would ask for God's help.
And it's so interesting. I mean, again, coming from, you know, you're going at this complete science background, and saying that to me, that's very encouraging.
Well, I find it very comforting. You know, there are so many physics arguments for why I think I'm on the right track. Another one, which I can just discuss very briefly, is it's well known that all the matter in the entire universe, whether we're talking about the universe eventually collapsing upon itself, you know, in the end, or whether it just continues to expand forever, it doesn't matter the scenario. Physicists know that either way, all the matter in the universe, after at least 10, and it's to the 36th power, which is a long time, of years, that all of the matter in the universe will become what? It will become light. So, you know, even for the atheists, they have to admit that it's not just ashes to ashes and dust to dust. It's actually, we're going to become light. So the arguments really just go on and on. I just think it's great.
It's very intriguing. Before we get into sort of the big picture, what it all means and tying it together,
yes.
Consciousness aspect of it.
Absolutely. The consciousness aspect originated with an experiment that I briefly mentioned called the double slit experiment. Again, you can look it up on the internet. I do warn you and your listeners, it's a very complex experiment. The experiment that I give when I give my talks around the country is I like to use one of its modified cousins called the quantum eraser. Quantum like quantum physics, eraser like pencil eraser. It's called the quantum eraser experiment. And what this experiment shows is that, and trying to keep it simple, light enters the experimental setup. So there's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end, with light traversing, you know, those various sections of the experiment. And it ends up at the end. And then everyone, the researchers, know what happens at the end of the experiment. Now, they modify this quantum eraser experiment, and they change the end of the experiment. Lo and behold, what happens? Light actually alters its behavior, not at the end where you'd expect it to. It actually alters its behavior in the middle, before it even reaches the end of the experiment. It's like it somehow knows what's in the future. You know, what's at the end of the experiment? Physicists have used the term, it anticipates, you know, the changes at the end. Physicists have used the term that it alters its behavior, almost like a human trait, and that led to the term of consciousness that so many physicists have used for this series of experiments, which I call the double-slit series of experiments. They go by all different names. The quantum eraser is just one of those modifications of the double-slit experiment. And it's kind of like what I was talking about at the beginning about omnipresence of light. It's so difficult for humans to accept because we think we know how light is supposed to act. You know, light is supposed to act like a sound wave. And if you see a wave, you expect it to do certain things. And all of a sudden, with time stopping or not existing for the light wave, what we were seeing with the quantum eraser experiment was that it was something that for humans we couldn't explain. But yet, if we understood the light wave, we understood that time does not exist for light, it made all the sense in the world. Time does not have to abide by rules of time. And what I think is happening, and I think many physicists agree with this, is that the light wave in the quantum eraser experiment was going to the end of the experiment, you know, and basically sensing or acknowledging the changes in the experiment. It was going back in time, going back, you know, in time from our human perspective, changing its behavior in the middle of the experiment. And for us humans, it didn't make any sense. We called it impossible, like Richard Feynman called it. We're shocked, as Niels Bohr called it. And yet for light, it made all the sense in the world because time doesn't exist. And what was so neat about the experiment, it allowed us as humans to actually see that time does not exist for it. You know, you can read about muons and you can conduct experiments where it appears to make sense that time doesn't exist. But when you actually see it happening, you know, it's like having a near-death experience. It is so transformational because you're actually seeing it happen. And it really makes a difference when you can, you know, more or less see it happen. So that's how the term consciousness came about. It was not a term that Lee Bauman came up with to describe light. It was actually, you know, quantum physicists, no less.
Well, you wouldn't be the first science-based guest to come on the show and say quantum physics proves everything we've been saying about spirituality.
Understood, yes. Hence the movie What the Bleep.
Yeah, absolutely. What the Bleep and the secret and everything to follow. It's really becoming widely accepted. But do you sort of see it that way, that quantum physics really kind of gives it the scientific footing to understand spirituality?
Oh, I do.
In fact,
there's, you know, I keep babbling on about all these neat science experiments. There's another experiment called the EPR experiment. E stands for Einstein, P for another physicist, Podolsky, R for Rosen. And that experiment actually shows that information, not particles, not waves, but information can travel faster than the speed of light. And my research would indicate that that information really is another term for consciousness, you know, kind of the cosmic consciousness of our mind, of our thought processes, is information. It's knowing. And the fact that it can travel faster than the speed of light makes a lot of sense to me. It's an acknowledgement that God is not limited by time, that the omnipresence of light, if indeed there is an intimate relationship between light and God, it would explain not only that God can be everywhere at one time, and the fact that he or she is also all-knowing, but that he or she can glean this information from around the universe faster than the speed of light, instantaneously, basically.
I'm curious how you see the observer effect in all of this, because, I mean, allegedly the observer effect would make any outcome proven in any experiment based on, and that's a quantum physics thing, too, is it not?
Well, I think it depends what observer effect you're referring to, because there are actually several. I suspect the observer effect that you're... Well, let me ask you, which observer effect are you referring to?
The quantum physics version, I think, where upon being observed, it collapses into out of wave into particles.
Oh, yes. Okay, certainly. Yes, that, in fact, physicists would say that's the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, that you see a tree and you take your eyes off of it. And Einstein asked a physicist who was interviewing him once, okay, now you're no longer looking at the tree, does that tree exist? And according to quantum physics, no. If you're not looking at it, or it's not being basically observed, you know, by some form of consciousness, that tree can really be anywhere in the universe. The odds are against it. The odds are favoring that it's right there where you last saw it. But theoretically, the next time you looked at it, it could be 10 feet, you know, to the right or 10 feet to the left. Einstein spent much of his life trying to disprove the Copenhagen interpretation, and he never could. It also explains the wave-particle duality of physics. You know, physicists have for years argued that light was a particle. No, light's a wave. No, wait a minute, light is a particle. You know, and it just goes back and forth. But the Copenhagen interpretation explains that by saying that if human consciousness is not in some form interacting with a wave, it will continue to exist as a wave. But as soon as human consciousness intervenes, whether it be by sight, smell, hearing, touch, sound, then automatically that wave condenses to a particle, or what physicists call collapse of the wave function, that wave collapses into a particle. And so that's how we recognize a picture on the wall, is those waves collapse through our retina and into our mind, and they become little dots that we recognize as a picture. You know, it's all very strange. I don't think anyone would say it makes much sense. Again, it's something that's proven, but it's still very mystical and very strange.
Now, if I'm carrying forward with your theory that you're presenting in your book, if God is light and light is God, what does that mean as far as what the nature of our existence is?
Boy, I wish I had the answer to that one.
Good question, though.
Oh, it is. And, you know, something I have struggled with is if all spirit is a form of light, which I think it may well be. And many NDE experiencers acknowledge that, you know, God is the brightest light that they experience. When they see deceased loved ones and friends, they are often seen as light, but they're not as bright. They're like a lower frequency or a lower intensity. There's always a difference between their light and the light of God or Christ. And one of the questions I've always asked, well, you know, if we're all going to become light, does that mean Hitler, you know, is also a spirit of light? And so it brings up these philosophic questions that I don't think anyone has the answer to. I know a lot of people who are a heck of a lot smarter than I am have observed that people, or spirits rather, who wish to associate with Satan and the devil, they do that voluntarily. It's not that God dismisses them or God particularly casts them off, although we read about, you know, that being true with Satan. But typically the story is that the spirits that do not align themselves with God do so voluntarily. They align themselves with Satan or the devil, and they do that of their own free will. You know, the controversy abounds as to what the significance of so much of this is. But I'm still searching.
It would be to ask you, too, that, I mean, if your exploration of my view scientifically to allude to the fact that light is God and God is light, and they're one and the same thing, or having the same properties, then that's always kind of, you know, personally had trouble with the whole sort of Satan story.
Yeah.
And that's why I was intrigued by the near-death experience that you mentioned, where there was an absence of light, and that was sort of the quote-unquote hellish experience as opposed to the peace and love and
right.
omniscience going on. And often people have talked about you're either connected to source or spirit or God or whatever words people, you know, in different belief systems use,
yes.
or not. And as you say, you're connecting or choosing not to connect. I mean, if it's light that God is, and then you're just kind of flicking off the switch and you're in the dark room, then, I mean, could that just be inferred that you're either connected in the light or not?
I don't know. That's such a great question, and I've thought so much about it when you hear people come up and tell you about some of these hellish NDEs that they've experienced, because they seem like good people. So many of them say, you know, yes, I believe in God, Dr. Bauman. Why would this happen to me? And, you know, sometimes I just wonder if it isn't a test, that God just wants to know if, you know, if you get in that situation, who are you going to look to for help? You know, and I think the correct answer is you're going to say, God, help me. Because so many times when these people do that, all of a sudden the light emerges and it becomes a, you know, one of those wonderful NDEs. Again, I don't know the answer. I'm just saying speculative, but it does make you wonder because you hear that so often.
Well, it really does, and that's why I was intrigued to talk to you, because no one has made that connection. I mean, we've sort of talked about, you know, light and going into the light and the light and likeness of being, and there's sort of been all these little inferences, but no one's come out and said, you know, wow, the scientific properties of light and how we talk about God are one and the same.
Right. Well, and I got to tell you, with my last book, when you really do the research into all these, you know, these small and even the major religions around the world, I was just blown over with how so many of them, And I'm talking the vast majority. There's only a small minority where God is not described in terms of light. It was just overwhelming, and I just, at one point, had to make the conclusion that these were not metaphors. It was just too common, you know, to be explicable in any other way.
Wow, interesting. Well, we are pretty much at the top of the hour here, but I want to thank you for doing the work that you've done and writing the books and making this available to people and being with us here today.
It has been an absolute pleasure, and again, I thank you so much for having me. I never tire of talking on this subject.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Dr. Lee Bowman, God at the Feet of Light is the book, and there are several others as well. Go check out his website, www.near-death.com/physics.html. And yet another confirmation or validation on the theory that quantum physics proves everything, and science does meet spirit right back at the beginning of the circle. So let's explore more. We're going to be back on, I don't even know what day it is. Isn't that refreshing? Oh, Thursday, excellent, thank you. Monday with another guest, and Lighten Up Tuesday, Lighten Up Literally, consciousness experiment in massive weight loss has taken a shocking turn, and we're going to unveil it then. So be there, newsforthesoul.com, and we'll see you then. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
This has been News for the Soul with Nicole Whitney. Visit us anytime online at www.newsforthesoul.com, where you can listen to all our previously aired shows at any time and so much more. Have a great week, and remember, what you focus on expands.